Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. A three-day weekend in the dead of winter might seem like a waste of a perfectly good holiday, but I had a blast on Martin Luther King Jr. Day this year. I was hosting the New York Guitar Festival Marathon Concert at Merkin Hall on the Upper West Side. It featured a slew of guitarists from North and South America and wrapped up with a set by the Brazilian guitarist Budgie Assad. Like I say, it was fun, although things did get a little interesting at the end. The last couple of times I was on stage, I had to do my job as MC and at the same time discreetly try to keep my pants from falling down. That's because Budgie Assad, who looked great in a long, slim-fitting dress, had forgotten to bring a belt, which she needed to clip on her wireless mic. So, ever the gentleman, I gave her mine. But if you're wondering why a guitarist needs a wireless mic, well, Budgie Assad is much more than a guitarist, and you'll see what I mean when she plays for us today here in the Soundcheck studio. Also today, that email you just sent your mom, although you really ought to call her more often, that email is treated by the internet exactly the same as some major tech company's rollout of a game-changing new app. That's called net neutrality. But some powerful forces want to change that, and we'll look at what it could mean for us less powerful forces. But to begin, it's another in our occasional series on the music venues of a bygone era. We call it Vanished Venues.
We're calling to the faraway town. A war is declared, a battle come down.
In past editions of this series, we've looked back at the Palladium and the old Metropolitan Opera House. And the legendary Village Gate. We've strolled through the Greenwich Village of the past to visit the Bottom Line. And Gertie's Folk City.
Oh, Paul and Silas bound to deal.
So yeah, we've done a fair amount of these Vanished Venues programs. Just not 3 days after the venue closes. But that's what we're doing today. Electronic music producer Dan Deacon was part of a four-night send-off for the music venue known simply by its Brooklyn street address, 285 Kent. Their final night was this past Sunday, though the party didn't actually stop until well into Monday morning. New York Times pop music critic John Caramonica was there and wrote about the closing of 285 Kent in Monday's Times. You can read it online at soundcheck.org. And John's on the line with us now. Hey, John.
What's up, John?
Well, you tell me. I mean, New York has always had its share of, let's say, semi-legal music venues.
Sure.
Going back to Prohibition. What made 285 Kent different?
The thing that always jumped out at me about 285 was this kind of, it never felt quasi-legal, even though it very much was. quasi-legal, verging on illegal. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things about the DIY community over the last, I don't know, say 10 years in Williamsburg is it's been getting more and more formalized. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't like to talk about. But, you know, there's a big difference between seeing a show at 285 Kent, which had security, which had, you know, gave contracts to the people who were playing, just like any other corporate venue would have an artist sign a contract. There's a big difference between that and what was going on at, you know, early Market Hotel, Shea Stadium, mm-hmm. maybe Death by Audio, although I think Death by Audio maybe secretly is a little bit more organized than it comes off as.
These are definitely DIY, and we're stretching it to say they're semi-legal. Is that what you're hinting at here?
I think each building has its own particular set of problems. Obviously, you know, there are the cops can come and shut you down if they so choose. 285 had an issue where a health inspector had come. 285 did not have a formal liquor license. They did sell beer, but they did not have a formal liquor license. So I think each building kind of came with its own set of problems.
But you write that, you know, in the article that the owners of 285 Kent, the people who were running this, actually did try to make it into something that, to all appearances, was a legit music venue, to the point that they even installed air conditioning. Which,
yeah, that was one of my great moments of show reviewing was the summer of 2012. I mean, come on. You know, I reviewed, you know, anywhere from 1 to 5 shows a week. And in the middle of the summer, you know, you see the calendar and you're like, oh, that's a good show going on in such and such a space in Williamsburg. And, oh, I'm going to sweat 4 hours. It's going to be brutal. And then I remember I showed up. I can't remember what show it was, but I showed up at 285 for some show, and I see these glorious things hanging from the ceiling, and I, you know, made a point to purposely, like, stand right under where the blast zone was. And I was just like, oh, it's magic. Oh, it's magic happening on Kent. But yes, they were trying. In short, they were trying, and they had a vision, and they had an organizational skill that I think was slightly further down the road than some of those other spaces.
So what were the problems ultimately that made it impossible for 285 Kent to continue?
Well, I think there's some things we know about, and there's some things we probably don't know about. I think the things we know about is, look at where 285 Kent is. This is Kent off the corner of South 2nd Street. That block, or that stretch of blocks on Kent, you look at that stretch, say, 5 to 10 years ago, it's largely abandoned. There's no residential towers. It's sort of a free-for-all of a two-way street right up against the river there. You look at it now, directly across the street, I think they're building a new residential tower. A few blocks to the further south is a huge residential complex. A couple blocks north is a very, very fancy new supermarket. Time and money was going to catch up to them. I don't think that that's exactly what was happening, say, this month, but say within 6 months or a year and a half, time and money was going to catch up to them. I also think that what you're seeing is part of a bigger picture of Williamsburg changing and these spaces wanting to become official, or other official spaces that have the character of a DIY space, maybe taking some of the energy away from the actual DIY spaces.
Right. It's worth pointing out 285 Kent was not the only music venue in the neighborhood or even on the block.
No, not on the block. I mean, it's right next door to Glasslands Gallery.
We're speaking with John Caramonica, pop music critic for the New York Times, who was at the final concerts of the music venue known as 285 Kent. And, John, they did go out with a bang, didn't they?
I mean, it was a fun night. I mean, one of the things that you could always sort of count on at 285 was a really energetic crowd, and bands, I think, always really responded well to the space. It's sort of a big empty warehouse, effectively, and I think bands enjoyed the mild chaos that you could create in a space like that. It didn't feel sort of as confined as a traditional venue.
And sort of headlining the final night, which was Sunday night,
right,
was the band that, for radio purposes, when they played here in our studio, we simply called them Effed Up.
No friends of the New York Times copy desk, I will say that.
or of the FCC, but let's hear a little bit from them.
Sunrise from the factory, raised, don't make it to the street.
Some music from the band that we'll call Effed Up for the moment. They have played here in our soundcheck studio. They played the final night at the music venue known as 285 Kent, which was at 285 Kent Street in Brooklyn. John Caramonica was there on closing night and wrote an article for the New York Times about it. You can read it at soundcheck.org. And there was a connection to Lou Reed at 285 Kent somehow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the good things about how 285 Kent shut down, which is in this very orderly fashion, is it allowed for all these sort of memorial pieces to come out, you know, both mine and also people who had done more histories of the space. And one of the things that came out in a couple of those pieces is the prior incarnation of that room was for a sort of performance collective that had been founded by someone who had previously been Lou Reed's personal assistant or music assistant, something along those lines. And they had found the space initially, that person had found the space initially, I think sort of as maybe a gear storage place for Lou Reed or a mm-hmm. sort of semi-practice space for Lou Reed, but ultimately it did not become that. But the person who found it ended up taking the lease regardless, making it a performance space, and then ultimately turning over the lease to the people who turned it into 285 Kent as we know it now.
And so 285 Kent as a music venue, as a DIY music venue, you date it to late 2010. So basically we're talking about a 3-year run. Is that unusually short, unusually long in DIY terms?
I would say it feels short to me. I wouldn't say it's necessarily short in DIY terms, but it's short in the sense that I think it had an impact in a very quick turn. And that's something that was attributable to the fact that the people who were involved with managing and booking had a tremendous amount of experience. Mm-hmm. These were not people who this was their first thing that they were doing at age 17 or age 19. These are people who I think were able to hit the ground running. Now, an interesting thing about 285, you compare it to sort of other venues that are maybe more closely associated with a particular sound.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think you're not going to see as much both generationally, because it's not like CBGB at the height of punk. You know, it's not like, you know, any number of hardcore places, you know, your Coney Island High hardcore shows or anything like that, or metal shows. But because the sound of kind of young, cool New York, for lack of a more artful way of putting it, because that sound is actually a more diverse sound, mm-hmm. what you saw at 285 Kent was a fairly diverse set of bookings. I mean, I've seen hip-hop there. I've seen dance music there. I've seen metal there. I've seen, you know, fake 90s grunge revival there. I've seen, you know, traditional indie rock. I've seen basically anything you can see in that one space. Now, you can argue that that means it didn't have an identity, but I actually think that that's much very reflective of what the average, you know, 18 to 23-year-old kid who's trying to be cool and is interested in new music, that's what their palette is like. Yeah. And 285 reflected that.
Listeners, what do you think? What will you miss about 285 Kent? Or what do you think about the DIY scene as it's currently constituted? Post a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Again, we're talking about the recent demise of 285 Kent, which joins the list of vanished venues that we've talked about on Soundcheck over the years. John, I want to play a song for you, especially because of the first line we're going to hear in this song. This is from one of my favorite bands on the Brooklyn music scene. The group is Parquet Courts.
I was walking through Ridgewood, Queens. I was flipping through magazines. I was so starving. Should I eat this? I was so starving. I was scratching off silver ink. I was deciding what to drink. I was so starving. And I was walking through Ridgewood, Queens. And I was flipping through magazines. I was so starving.
just a little bit of the song Stoned and Starving by the band Parquet Courts. John Caramonica, it opens with that line, I was walking through Ridgewood, Queens.
Sure.
Is that where the DIY scene is? Is it just like, is all of Brooklyn now so priced out for these folks that that's where it's going?
I wouldn't say all of Brooklyn. I mean, Ridgewood has the benefit of basically being just on the other side of the Brooklyn-Queens border. So I wouldn't say it's that all of Brooklyn is priced out so much as you look at sort of the patterns of gentrification of young kids, and you look at, like, basically where the L train goes and where the G train, you know, where the trains take you, and you always sort of go one or two stops further out. And Ridgewood is a more logical follow place than, say, you know, Bay Ridge or Sunset Park.
Right.
But Ridgewood certainly is a neighborhood that I think is in turn right now, or having its turn. I'm interested to see if actually people are going to return to Brooklyn and start moving sort of, you know, Crown Heights, Brownsville, East New York, or Sunset Park, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I'm curious about for the next 3 to 5 years. Because you're getting to a point with Bushwick where a lot of, obviously there's plenty of stuff that's yet to be turned in Bushwick,
mm-hmm.
but it's happening at a faster clip, and frankly, real estate development is speeding up, and it's catching up to where the kids are going. So you don't just have a situation where it's young kids who are looking for cheap spaces where they can throw shows or have art galleries or whatever. You also have real estate developers who are like, oh, that's where the young kids are. Let's get in there, knock that building down, and build a residential place there. Those are starting to catch up. And this is another way in which the professional and the underground are intersecting, except in this case it's real estate where they're intersecting. You have the pros and you have the indie kids both fighting for the same spaces.
And right now that's in places like Bushwick and Ridgewood.
Absolutely.
Is there anything really new in this story, though, John? Hasn't this always been the case here in New York?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons you can't get too sad about it. I mean, I'm sad in the sense that that's a place where I saw a bunch of good shows, and I know as well. I mean, look, as someone who spends a fair amount of my work life going to concerts, I like to have places that I feel are reliable, places that I trust, bookers that I trust, venues that I trust, places with an aesthetic point of view. So obviously you want to mourn when one of those things goes away or one of those people goes away. But no, the scene doesn't exist in a place. The scene doesn't exist in a room. The scene exists in the energies and passions of the kids who bring it to those spaces. So ultimately, we'll be doing this again 3 years from now or 5 years from now about some other space that I haven't even been to yet.
Right. John Caramonica, pop music critic for the New York Times. He wrote a piece for Monday's edition of the paper detailing the close of the music venue 285 Kent. You'll find it on our website, soundcheck.org. Listeners, what do you think? What will you miss about 285 Kent? What do you think of the DIY music venue scene? Post your comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave a message on our voicemail, 866-939-1612. John, nice talking with you again.
Likewise. Solidarity, man.
This is Soundcheck. Next, Brazilian singer and guitarist Baji Assad. She joins us to play live in the studio. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and that is All One Woman, live on stage. Baji Assad plays the guitar and she sings, although here she's doing some humming and some mouth percussion at the same time. We recorded this on stage at the New York Guitar Festival back in 2008. But today, we'll get to hear the Brazilian guitarist, singer, and songwriter here in the Soundcheck studio. Her first song today has an English title. It's called To Reach My Heart. It's Budgie Assad, live on Soundcheck.
Look deeply into my eyes, so soft. You caress my soul, so slow. You leave me calm, so hard. You bring me the sun. If you want to reach beyond my heart, if you want to reach my heart, look deeply into my eyes, so gentle, you make me shiver, so deep that you could see shining bright through the night. If you want to reach beyond my heart, if you want to reach. When you look my way, wake the little girl inside me. When you hear my voice, write a beautiful song. When you dive inside of me, within my life, you know all the secrets to reach beyond my. You can cross every little path. You'll find that all the fruits have ripened, planting your love bit by bit in the little land. In the little land beyond my heart. If you want.
The Brazilian singer and guitarist Budgie Assad and her song To Reach My Heart, live on Soundcheck. That's not the first time I've heard you sing in English, but, you know, most of your songs tend to be in Portuguese or
yeah.
or in no language.
Yeah, my last album, Between Love and Luck, has
12 tracks, and 4 or 5 are in English.
Mm-hmm. So the funny thing is that song has such a Brazilian sound to it, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I guess, I mean, you come from, there's so much music in Brazil, but even by Brazilian standards, you come from a very musical family, right?
Lucky me!
Yeah.
So when I was inside my mom's belly, there was already guitar and music in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't escape. Actually, when I was a young kid, and where do you want to be when you grow up? I would say dancer, because music was so much there. It's like water and sun, music,
right.
Guitar. I want to do something different. But even then, I started playing piano when I was 8 because of my mom's dream,
mm-hmm.
was to be
a
pianist.
That you'd be anything but a guitarist in a
yes.
family full of guitarists. Your brothers are Sergio and Odair Assad,
oh, yeah.
Well known to many listeners as the Assad brothers or the duo
yeah.
Assad.
They are almost completing 50 years of career.
50 years?
In 2 years is going
wow.
to be it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man. I remember that first American release on None Such Records that came out in, I guess, the mid-80s. That's
yeah,
already a long time
yeah,
ago.
Yeah.
And they also have, your brothers have daughters
oh,
who play
my Lord.
As well.
Yeah, we'll be touring the family. We have a quintet now. I'll be back in April with the family, which is my brothers, mm-hmm. myself, and Odair's daughter, Carolina, that lives in Rio, and Clarice, Sergio's daughter, that is a pianist, a composer, a singer, amazing arrangement.
Yeah, she's a terrific songwriter. Yeah.
Oh, she lives here in New York, so, yeah.
So there's still enough Assads to carry on the tradition. So, but you've gotten kind of away from just doing Brazilian music.
Oh, yeah.
You've listened to a lot of different things over the years.
Well, when I started, I was a classical guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was following my
like
brothers.
Like your brothers,
yes.
Yeah.
But then I realized that it wasn't me, wasn't for me, just play the guitar. And when I put the voice into the work, I discovered that the voice also... And the voice came because in 89, I put out my first album, LP. So I started imitating the sounds of the other instruments. That's how my voice really entered in my music.
As an instrument.
As an instrument, like the flute. Okay, I can imitate the melody and so on, and the percussion, etc.
Well, now that raises an interesting question, because one of the things you're doing here in New York is a score to an old silent movie called The Goddess, a
yeah.
Chinese movie from 1934.
Yes.
So is that going to be just the guitar? Will you be using your voice in that as
it's
well?
It's 1 hour and 12 minutes of uninterrupted music. So when David invited me
That's
to...
That's David Spellman, who
Spellman.
Founded the
yeah.
New York Guitar Festival.
He put me, I saw as a challenge, I've never done such a thing. So I said, yes, I do everything. I sing. It's kind of a one-woman band because I do more... the movie, it's a very dance story.
Yeah.
So I don't put lyrics, but the voice is there. And I use a lot of tricks. Object that interferes in the sound of
oh,
the guitar.
Oh, you prepare the strings and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting what I've done. I'm very proud of the result.
Well, we'll get a chance to hear that on Thursday night at Merkin Concert Hall as part of the New York Guitar Festival. Baji Assad will be doing her new score to this old silent movie called The Goddess, as part of the New York Guitar Festival. And she's playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. You want to play another song for us? This one's in Portuguese, right?
Yes.
What's this called?
Noite de São João.
It's Baji Assad live on Soundcheck.
Solidão. Logo depois ele pousou numa fez surgir lágrimas de amor com tudo aquilo que desejei, que foi reconquistar o seu coração e te lembrar de quanto beijei sua boca durante todo o verão. Tinundero, virirão, minde, direi um guarão. Só me resta torcer pra que a chuva caia bem ao chão, onde os respingos bem de mansinho vão aquecendo seu coração. E traga ele pra bem pertinho de mim, pra me acolher até o fim, mesmo que de vez em quando eu precise de outro balão para fazer chover. Mesmo que de vez em quando eu precise fazer chover de novo minha paixão, foi numa noite de São João. Uraru.
That is Baji Assad, the Brazilian singer and guitarist, live on Soundcheck with Noite de São João, the name of that song. I guess I came relatively close.
St. John's.
The night, John. Night at St. John, right?
Yeah.
Baji Assad performing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today, performing her new score to the silent film The Goddess as part of the New York Guitar Festival on Thursday night, the 23rd at Merkin Hall. Baji is here with me on Soundcheck today. You want to do one of your vocal improvisations for us?
Yeah. You kind of started, like, it was a surprise. I didn't know you were going to play that in the beginning.
That is Baji Assad. So how did you learn to do that? I mean, people nowadays are familiar with, you know, musicians coming in with digital pedals that allow them to loop stuff. You did all of that live right here in the studio. How did you learn to make the percussive sounds and the humming at the same time?
I realized that it was possible. In the beginning, it wasn't easy. I had a score. I was like, in top of this note, I'm going to do this.
Oh, so you actually wrote it all out?
In the beginning, yes. Yeah. But then became a natural. But I'm talking since the beginning of the 90s, I was starting to do this.
Yeah.
So now it's my head worked more like a drummer than a guitar player.
Right.
You know, because I can split the body and do all this polyrhythm stuff and play the guitar while I do this and that. It's fun.
The only time you had to stop playing was when you hit your cheeks with both hands to get the kind of percussive effect. It's fun to watch. So now you spent, there were a couple of years towards the end of the 90s where you couldn't play the guitar for a while, right?
Oh, yeah. I had focal dystonia.
That's the same thing that Leon Fleischer, the classical pianist, had.
A lot of musicians discover they have it. I was one of the first one to discover and speak out loud what I had.
So focal dystonia, it's actually a problem in the brain, right?
It
affects
it's,
the nerve
like
control.
It's like a stroke in a specific part of your body, like very focal. And mine was the two fingers in my left hand. So I lost like 98% of my ability to play guitar.
Wow.
For 2 years, I couldn't, like, and but I overcame it.
How?
Well, it was a journey, because back then, nobody was talking about it.
Yeah.
So I left the doctor's office like, good luck, with good luck.
Well, you know, I mentioned Leon Fleischer. He found out he had focal dystonia years after wondering why his right hand was no longer working.
Oh.
And what ended up working for him were Botox injections into
yeah.
his right forearm. And he jokes he now has the smoothest forearm in all of music.
It may not work for other people too.
Mm.
So I heard people that tried and didn't work.
Okay.
It's more like for me, it was like a spiritual journey that took me to an entire new way of looking at my life, you know, and the music, what it is for me. And actually, the funny, interesting, and curious part of it is when I was, from the bottom of my heart, I said, I'm okay if I never play the guitar again. I start playing again.
Wow.
So it was a very nice exercise of letting go. So when I let that go, God gave me back.
Well, that is kind of a journey. And now you're on another journey. You have a 6-year-old daughter.
Oh,
you took a couple
Lord.
Of years off for that.
More than a couple. Yeah, she was born in... Well, my last CD, Wonderland, was released in 2006. So she came in 2007.
Yeah.
And I only put an album out last year.
Last year.
So a long time break. And it was, for sure, the best release of my life.
I was just going to say, that's a good reason to take a few years off as well, unlike the first one. Baji, great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A bit more music from my guest, the singer and guitarist Baji Asad, and that song is called Pishaim. Coming up, the movement known as Net Neutrality aims to even the playing field for internet users, but can it benefit musicians? Find out next. This is Soundcheck.
We're sick of being checked around. We all fall down. It's been a bad day. Please don't take a picture. It's been
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Since the beginning of the internet, back when it was just a little baby series of tubes, there's been the question of who owns cyberspace. Well, the web is now mind-bogglingly complex. We use it for work, for play. We certainly use it for music, discovering, downloading, streaming it. Now, the question of whether we all have equal access to the internet is once again a hot topic. And joining me by phone from Washington is the interim executive director of the Future of Music Coalition, Casey Ray. The coalition was responsible for 2007's Rock the Net campaign that featured bands like REM and Pearl Jam, all advocating for a so-called neutral net. Now, Casey, what is a neutral net?
You know, the idea of net neutrality is actually really simple. Most folks understand that when you pick up a telephone to make a call, the carrier doesn't put you on hold so the rich people can talk first.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if you're in a band and you finish practice and you go to order a pizza from the local joint, the operator doesn't prioritize the calls to Domino's. So people expect the internet to work that way too. But the issue is, without basic rules laying out what your service provider is allowed to do, things could change really quickly and we could end up with an internet that looks more like your cable television package.
So it's like if I'm posting a photo on Instagram, that should get as much priority on the internet as Apple rolling out a new version of iTunes or something like that.
That's right. You know, net neutrality only applies to lawful content. So this is, music and other media that's delivered over the internet with the expectation that it's going to reach its customers.
Mm-hmm.
In America, there's just a few companies that offer internet service, so that's part of the problem. And they want to make more money by charging content providers, and this could be anyone with a website, service, or application, extra money for the privilege of reaching the end user. And that makes sense, but you can see how it would be bad for regular internet users because they don't know why their favorite site loads slow or is harder to access. But for musicians and other creators, it's even worse. Here's an example. You might have heard about the dissatisfaction that some artists have about payouts on streaming music services
right.
like Spotify.
Right.
Well, there are other sites that a lot of musicians use, like Bandcamp, which offers more pricing flexibility and the ability to know who your fans are. Well, what happens if an internet service provider decides that it likes Spotify best because they have the deepest pockets? And what about a future innovation that might be even more artist-friendly? How can they even get off the ground if there's no guarantee that they can deliver that music to an audience?
Mm. So a neutral net is the internet that we have come to know.
That's right.
And who's been watching, who's been minding the store and making sure it stays neutral?
Well, to a large extent, musicians, other content creators, folks in the innovation space, anyone who understands that permissionless innovation, the idea to be able to engage in creative expression, free speech, to build the next great service, folks like that intuitively get that net neutrality is important. And, independent labels even remember the old days when they couldn't compete with the majors
mm-hmm.
for shelf space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe these giant international entertainment conglomerates can afford to pay for prioritized service, but what about a startup label that treats its artists fairly and just wants a shot at, reaching folks in the marketplace? And keep in mind that some of the internet service providers already own major content companies. I don't know if we can really trust them to keep the lanes open to competitors.
All right, so what has changed? What has happened to make net neutrality a somewhat iffy proposition all of a sudden?
Well, this has been a policy debate for at least the last 10 years here in D.C. And the FCC in 2010 issued an open internet order. And this was meant to preserve a level online playing field. So anybody could compete. Anybody with a great idea, a great song, was able to use the internet to reach their fans, their audiences, their patrons. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals in D.C. recently threw out that order, said the FCC didn't have authority to issue it in the first place. Now, this is actually a problem of the FCC's own making, because back in the early 2000s, the commission chose to reclassify broadband internet as an information service instead of a telecommunications service, like those phone lines that I talked about.
Mm.
And that put them in a regulatory bind that they've been trying to sort of wiggle out of ever since.
Now, basically, they said it was something that was outside their purview. They are the Federal Communications Commission.
Sure.
And now they're trying to backtrack and say, no, it is communications after all, and we should control it.
Well, the most straightforward solution would be to simply reclassify. And the Supreme Court has said that they have the right to do that if they can provide justification. Now, even the court that just threw out the existing rules seems to agree that this is probably the clearest way for the FCC to preserve a level playing field.
Okay. All right. We're speaking with Casey Ray. He's the interim executive director of the Future of Music Coalition in Washington, D.C. Their Rock the Net campaign for a free and open internet featured bands like Pearl Jam and REM, OK Go, etc. The FCC was on one hand of this court case. They were on one side. The other side was who? It was Verizon, right?
Sure. Verizon were parties to the court case. They sued the FCC in federal appeals court. And previously, Comcast had sued the FCC before the internet order just for basically scolding them for degrading content, slowing content.
Really? So you can do that? You can sue somebody just because they were mean to you?
Well, in the world of Washington, if you have enough lawyers, you can do a lot of things.
Okay. So the idea that in a non-neutral web where there is priority given to those with deeper pockets, that sounds bad enough. Do we need to worry about these internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast and all the rest, do we need to worry then about them being able to censor or to somehow suppress different things on the web?
A lack of authority in general to issue rules about what they can and can't do affects everything that touches the web. So, even those phone lines that we were talking about, they're now migrating to voice over internet protocol, right? The phone lines themselves are becoming delivered through the internet. So the inability to have rules of the road really affects everything in today's communication space. Mm-hmm. And there is some precedent. Back in 2007, AT&T censored a Pearl Jam concert. Eddie Vedder was saying some critical remarks about then-President George W. Bush, and, you know, they came up with all kinds of excuses about it, an overzealous operator broadcasting the webcasting the Lollapalooza concert that the band was playing at. But you get the idea. It's not something that we can feel good about leaving in the hands of just a couple of corporations.
All right, well, this is from that 2007 concert by Pearl Jam. You'll hear Eddie Vedder trying to get the crowd to sing along with him as the band segues into a cover of Pink Floyd's The Wall. And he's you'll hear what he's trying to ad-lib.
We don't.
If you were listening, that's what you heard. The song just cutting out abruptly like that when Eddie Vedder sings, George Bush leave this world alone. He was then going to go on, it did go on stage, to say, George Bush, go find yourself another home. Casey Ray, AT&T said it was a mistake and apologized, right?
Well, it's good for them to apologize for censoring those creative speech of a performer, but you can see how insidious this is, because if you were at the concert, you heard what he said from the stage. Maybe
right.
You didn't like it, maybe you thought it was awesome, but, you know, it wasn't censored.
Well, was this censored? Was this censored? I mean, certainly, as of 2007, we hadn't worked all the kinks out of live streaming and stuff, and even today, it's not uncommon to have stuff drop out like that.
There are dropouts, that's for sure, but it was a little bit suspicious. You know, you can imagine that even political, in this era of, Citizens United and super PACs, you can imagine that without any checks on this, those who can afford to pay for premium content delivery could have that content reach their customers mm-hmm. or their intended audiences, and folks who weren't able to do that might have a harder time. So whenever you get folks in a policy debate that includes strange bedfellows, like, you know, you have the ACLU on one hand in this, and then you have Christian groups on the other, normally they might not agree, but they agree very much on the basic concept of net neutrality because they understand that it's really important to be able to get their message to their intended audiences. And obviously musicians who, you know, need every chance they get to be able to cultivate relationships and attract fans, they've come to depend on the internet this entire time, and it would be really devastating if it became kind of a locked down corporate environment, because we remember what happened with commercial radio.
Well, and I want to get to that because there's an interesting comparison to be made. Casey Ray is with us on Soundcheck. He's with the Future of Music Coalition in Washington, D.C. Their Rock the Net campaign a few years back featured Pearl Jam and REM and OK Go and a bunch of other bands campaigning for a free and open internet. But Casey, the net as we've known it, which has been neutral, as you alluded to before, it has not been great for a lot of musicians. With all the music streaming and stuff, there are, you know, thousands and thousands of streams, and a musician makes just a couple of pennies out of that. So, you know, is there a possible benefit to musicians to something other than the internet as we've come to know it?
Well, I don't think that you can really put the toothpaste back in the tube with regard to the internet. And I do think a lot of the musicians, most of the ones that I talk to, they have concerns about the business models. They may even be really worried about piracy and unauthorized distribution. Net neutrality rules, the order that the FCC came up with in 2010 only applied to lawful content, right?
So it doesn't apply to piracy.
Exactly. So, you know, we can have the debate about the best ways to approach piracy, and we can also be really rational about what types of structures benefit musicians in terms of their compensation. And that's one of the worries. Like, if the major labels are very invested in one content delivery platform, and that content delivery platform is extremely well capitalized and can afford to pay the ISP for premium delivery, that kind of locks down the system. It locks musicians into a potentially unfair or disadvantageous economic arrangement.
Is this what happened with commercial radio?
Well, commercial radio, it was definitely a policy decision that resulted in kind of the rise of Clear Channel and its ilk. In 1996, Congress passed the Telecommunications Act, and what that did was remove the caps on the number of stations a broadcast entity could own. So
right.
Almost overnight, you had all of the moms and pop stations just gobbled up by these big radio conglomerates. I'm old enough to remember, you know, when I was a kid, you probably could have put a blindfold on us and driven us across the country, and we would have been able to tell you where we were based on what was on the radio. You know when you're in New Orleans, you know you when you're in Detroit, you know when you're in Nashville, so on and so forth. That's not as much the case anymore. You could drive across the country from coast to coast and hear the same songs. It would be a tremendous tragedy if the internet ended up being like that, because one of the promises of the web was that it offered more diversity of content, and that part has been borne out. Access to potential audiences and a diversity of entertainment options is a good thing.
So
we're
going to
get the business models right, and yes, we should combat piracy in the most thoughtful way possible.
And so what happens next? There has been this appeal by Verizon, which has been upheld against the FCC. So the Court of Appeals saying the FCC doesn't have the right to kind of insist on net neutrality. What's the next step?
Well, the ball is squarely in the FCC's court yet again. There's a new chairman of the commission, Tom Wheeler, who was just sworn in by the Senate a little while ago, and he has some decisions to make. His predecessor was responsible for, you know, getting the votes together at the commission to issue the order to begin with. The problem is they did it under a rationale of authority that the court has subsequently invalidated. So the FCC could choose to reclassify. They could take a deep breath and they could say, this is what we're going to do. We got it wrong back in the early 2000s. We're going to clarify this. Everything's going to work out. At least we'll understand what we're dealing with here. But again, they're going to face tremendous opposition from the telecom.
It's a very intricate and complex issue. And one that, to quote one of the bands that you, Casey, have worked very closely with at the Future of Music Coalition, all is not lost. That's the name of a song by the band OK Go. Damian Kulash has written a lot about this issue and has spoken about it on Soundcheck as well. We've been talking with Casey Ray at the Future of Music Coalition in Washington. Casey, thanks for sort of making some sense of this for us.
Thank you.
Here is that OK Go song called All Is Not Lost. Today on Soundcheck.org, we premiered a new song by the Queens-based singer-songwriter Juan Waters. Juan also plays with the New York group The Beats, but his upcoming solo album is called NAP North American Poetry, and this song comes from that. It's called Escucho Mucho from Juan Waters.
Escucho mucho, suena retrucho, un cucurucho, un helado de afuera, son de otra era, y es que es de madera toda su piel, y como el viento que sopla lento, es
That's the Queens-based singer-songwriter Juan Waters and his song Escucho Mucho. Read more about him and the song on soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, the trio known as London Grammar has gathered millions of YouTube views for its moody, trippy songs. Hear why when the band plays live. Our theme song is called Eagle Rock by keyboardist Marco Benevento. Find out more about Marco on soundcheck.org. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, Jason Isaac, and George Wellington. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. That does it for Soundcheck today. I'm John Schaefer.